James, we will go ahead and turn the floor over to you.
All right. That's good. And thank you, David, for having me. And you can pull up my presentation. Feel free to come back to me because I only have a couple of slides to show you some charts about some of the things I want to cover.
Okay.
I mean, which is really about where the state gets its money and where that money gets spent. I think it's really important for you guys to know this because the state constitution gives the legislative branch ultimate control over fiscal policy. And this is an attempt by our framers to ensure popular control of the state's purse. This responsibility is underappreciated, and legislators have more collective control over the budget than they get credit for. Now, state budgeting is a challenge. There are unlimited demands made upon lawmakers, and yet the state has a limited amount of revenue. Budgeting becomes a matter of prioritization. This process gets complicated by the strings placed on revenue sources, which restrict money to dedicated purpose, but even or dedicated purposes. But even with those restraints, the state budget is flexible, and lawmakers have options to budget according to their priorities. So let's get down to basics. Michigan, like other states, operates with a balanced budget per Article 5, Section 18 of the state constitution. That is, it spends the revenue that it brings in each year. And Michigan taxes collect over $30 billion annually. The state's largest tax is the personal income tax, where the state claims 4.25% of household income. And this collects around $10 billion in revenue. Next are sales and use taxes, where the state's claim on 6% of sales generates a little less than $10 billion. The state charges 6 mills in property taxes. That collects another $2 billion. Fuel taxes and vehicle registration taxes combined for another $2.8 billion. And the state has a lot of these targeted taxes, so like gambling taxes, alcohol taxes, hospital taxes, that when combined raise $5.8 billion. Now, this is just the state's taxes. The state also authorizes local governments to assess a number of taxes, the biggest which are property taxes and income taxes. So schools, counties, municipalities, and other taxing jurisdictions levy $15.3 billion worth of property taxes, in addition to the 24 cities that levy local option income taxes worth $1.6 billion. Now, when you compare Michigan's tax structure and its rates to other states, Michigan resides in that vast middle of being neither an especially high tax state nor an especially low tax state. We have all of the major taxes that states assess, so income taxes, sales taxes, property taxes, business taxes, and some states do without one of them. But while Michigan levies all of these taxes, none are at atypically high rates. Property taxes in the city of Detroit aside, but that's complicated by the fact that property values in Detroit took such a hit. Now, if we want to pull up the next slide, the tax foundation ranks states based on their tax structures and puts Michigan in that upper middle tier at the 12th best tax structure, and second only to Indiana in our region. Now, a note of caution about these. They have to make their own judgments when ranking states. So by their methods, Michigan gets extra points for having a flat rate income tax, while Ohio gets dinged for having progressive rates and high local option income taxes, for instance. Now, also, I know that this slide says that it's a business tax climate index, but the Tax Foundation takes an expansive view of what business taxes are and include all of the major taxes levied by state and local governments, not just corporate income taxes and other business taxes. And it's the most comprehensive comparison that's available. Now, the legislature has control over the base and the rates of the taxes that it assesses, and it is up to the legislature to determine how to spend the money those taxes raise. Now, state spending interests are uncomfortable that this authority resides with legislators, because when funding is up to elected representatives, there is no guarantee that it will continue. So they are naturally worried that future lawmakers will have different priorities, and they want certainty that money will keep flowing to their causes regardless of who gets elected. Now, sometimes legislators attempt to bind themselves by restricting their revenue sources. Still, if we can pull up the next slide. The only the restrictions in the Constitution tend to be binding. The rest are just pledges from previous lawmakers that legislators today should feel no qualms about revisiting. In general, it takes as many votes to change restrictions as it does to pass budgets. And the people who made statutory restrictions knew that. Even our Supreme Court justices know that, as in, you can see the quote here, the legislature in enacting a law cannot bind future legislatures. In other words, the laws restricting legislative budget priorities are a magician's handcuffs. The appearance might be important, but they're not binding. The Constitution is different, however. So I want to talk a little bit about the constitutional restrictions on revenue and the flexibility that lawmakers have around those restrictions to set their own priorities. So 73% of the sales tax is set by the Constitution to go to the school aid fund. But there is flexibility to increase or decrease school funding even with this dedication. So state universities tend to be paid in unrestricted state funds, but can also receive these restricted funds. Likewise, schools can receive general funds when they are eligible for restricted revenues too. Now, the state has an additional constitutional sales tax dedication to cities, villages, and townships to be distributed based on how many people are in those cities, villages, and townships. Legislators budget that constitutional allotment and provide additional money on top of that. So there's flexibility in reducing or increasing revenue sharing if it is a priority. Another constitutional dedication is that fuel taxes have to be spent on transportation purposes per Article 9, Section 9 of the state constitution. This is part of the partial user fee financing mechanism the state uses for road funding. And the idea is that people who use the roads burn fuel in using the roads. So taxing their fuel connects users to road finance. Now, the voters who added this restriction did not want this tax to be spent on other purposes. But there is flexibility here as well, because the state also spends a lot more than this constitutional allocation on transportation, which allows lawmakers to increase or decrease road funding to if it is a priority. So even with constitutional dedications, there's flexibility to ensure that lawmakers can spend on their priorities even around constitutional earmarks. Still, there are ways that legislators can tie their hands that are legal and legitimate. So the state signs contracts and must uphold the terms of what it agrees to. A state can go into debt for dedicated purposes and bind itself both to a payment schedule and for the uses for which that debt was approved. The state can also make agreements with the federal government over how money is to be spent. During the last recession, for instance, the state agreed not to lower its own spending on some budget areas in exchange for stimulus money. If we want to bring up the next chart, which is, we'll scroll through it because it's a big chart. We've covered the first two columns of what the state's taxes are and the restrictions on this. So let's talk about where money gets spent. So if we're talking about broad strokes, Michigan spends the majority of its revenue on schools and Medicaid. Over $13 billion goes to schools. Now, we've got a primer on our website for the details about all of that, but we generally fund education on a per pupil basis. So if we have more money, it means we can increase per student payments. But we leave school districts to determine how that money gets spent. Though I hope you'll also be part of my presentation on pensions, where I cover some of how lawmakers affect decisions about how schools spend their money as well. Now, around $8 billion in taxpayer money goes to the Department of Health and Human Services, which carries another $18 billion in federal transfers. Transportation purposes take another $3.6 billion. Corrections get around $2 billion. And so this is just a chart that has basically summarized all of my presentation so far into just one page. It's a little dated, but as you can see, first column is taxes. The second column shows how funds are restricted. And the third column shows how it is spent. Now, these are broad strokes, and I don't want to brush away the little details, which are important. The state's select business subsidy programs, I think, are unfair, ineffective, and expensive, even if they're a small part of the budget. The state's higher education funding, I think, accomplishes little for the money we spend and should be reviewed even if it's not as big of an expenditure as K-12 education. Now, while I want legislators to regularly review spending in order for them to redirect money to higher priorities, that's not usually how lawmakers pay for their priorities. Rather, they tend to dedicate the growth of tax revenue to accomplish the things they want to accomplish. And so the next chart I've got is the growth of the state budget. State revenue has increased by $8.9 billion over the past decade, which is 16%, and a 16% increase above inflation. So this growth was led by a 41% increase in the personal income tax, or in personal income tax revenue, and a 33% increase in transportation tax revenue with those gains adjusted for inflation. Now, to go back to my point about lawmakers accomplishing their priorities with growth, I want to talk about transportation taxes. Over the past 10 years, roads have been a priority. Road funding has increased from $2 billion to $3.6 billion. And part of that increase was because lawmakers raised taxes by $600 million after a disastrous ballot question and much consternation. But the other $1 billion of that increase was accomplished by making roads a priority for budget growth. Growth has mattered more to roads than the hard-fought tax hike. Now, growth likewise drove increases to other priorities that legislators had, like school funding, university funding, and local government transfers. Now, unfortunately, the pandemic hit and has negated a lot of the recent growth, which you can see in this next chart. So that Michigan lost revenue is unsurprising, given both the precautions that people took to prevent the spread of the coronavirus and the state's restrictive orders. And as this chart, but there is some good news here. As this chart shows, officials expect that the state budget will grow again from current year revenue levels. So if you are successful in your campaigns, you will likely be presiding over discussions about where to spend more money in a recovery than what the state can afford to reduce. Now, another thing I wanted to cover was that we've been talking about budgets, but legislators have a lot of control over fiscal policy that gets made outside of budget negotiations. There's a lot of legislation that affects how much we spend that doesn't go through appropriations committees. So consider the pension systems that the state operates. Michigan pays billions each year to pay down debts in the school retirement system. It's been underfunded due to bad funding assumptions and deferment of the state's debt payments. This meant that legislators accidentally made school employees the state's largest creditors, and that's a bad thing for teachers, schools, and taxpayers alike. Lawmakers have reformed the system to stop generating new pension debts and to pay down what is owed. These are huge fiscal policy decisions that just get built into budget assumptions. So while revisiting those decisions may not be at the forefront of each budget negotiations, or of each budget negotiation, they have large effects on how the state spends its money. Likewise, for other issues like Medicaid eligibility, state decisions about who is eligible are built into tomorrow's budgets. And for another example, lawmakers have been building bipartisan consensus to keep the people released from prison from committing more crimes. If their programs are successful, there are huge benefits for society as a whole, and some of those benefits go to savings in the corrections budget. Affecting these trends changes long-term fiscal policy, even if they don't seem to have an effect on this year's budget. So we've gone through how the state gets its money, income taxes, sales taxes, and everything else. We've seen how some of that money is restricted and the options that lawmakers have around those restrictions. We've seen how money gets spent, schools, Medicaid, and everything else. We looked at how lawmakers accomplish their priorities, mostly through growth, but sometimes through cuts or tax hikes. And we've looked at revenue trends. Now, for my final point, I just want to emphasize that fiscal policy is in control of the legislature. It is often pointed out that the general fund represents only a small part of the budget, and that's the only part that the legislature really controls. But that's inaccurate, since restrictions often are in the hands of legislators as well. And there are those who feel that statutory restrictions are moral obligations. And this is incomplete at best. I mean, legislators' moral and constitutional responsibility is to try to enact popular fiscal policy. If statutory restrictions stand in the way, then it is the responsibility of legislators to change those statutes, budget around them, or challenge how binding those restrictions are. Now, with that, I hope this has been useful to you, and I'll be happy to address any of your questions or concerns.
All right. Thank you, James. If you have a question for him, please feel free to put that into the chat room. Either click the button on the bottom of the screen that says chat or click Alt-H on your keyboard. That'll open up the window. First question, can you discuss the difference between constitutional and statutory income sharing and why Michigan is dead last?
Well, so when you're looking at the trends for these distributions, so Michigan takes some money, distributes some to local governments via the form of revenue sharing. We talked about the constitutional allocation, which is done on a per capita basis. That one's been in the Constitution for a long time. It's pretty automatic each year. They just get 10% off the top of the sales tax, gets built in the budgets, and they haven't tried to shy away from that. Statutory revenue sharing is another thing. The state has set up its own formula for distributions of that money, which is not on a per capita basis, but it's been part of some long-term political compromises. And the issue is that the fact that Michigan has spent less over a period of time is largely a factor of where Michigan was. We went through a decade-long recession before everyone else joined us in 2007 and 2008. And so when you look and compare our revenue sharing or distributions to local governments over that period of time, we tend to be last in everything. Now, part of that was at the time, especially in 2000s, the state was looking at local governments and saying, you know, income taxes are down a lot, but property taxes are up. You guys are collecting a lot of these local property taxes. So they transferred some of the state's losses to local governments. I hope that helps answer your question.
And I have two related questions. Mm-hmm. Do some districts get paid more per student than other districts?
Yes. Fund equity has been merging ever since Proposal A, but it was a long-term kind of thing. In addition, there are categorical grants that mean that some districts get extra allotments that others don't get. Again, if you want to dig in on this, we've got a primer. It's a school financing primer that covers those issues. It's something that lawmakers have been dealing with a lot over time. In addition, there are some districts that rely exclusively on property taxes and receive no additional transfers from the state. And those tend to be in like vacation communities, and they get nothing from the state, but they wind up having high per pupil allocations.
How does Michigan's total indebtedness per capita compare to surrounding states?
Okay, so this is an interesting question because there is official bonded debt, there are revenue debt, and then there's the really important pension debt. Michigan has less than $2 billion of general obligation debt right now. It's very low. I don't have a good comparison to all the states, but I suspect we're probably one of the lowest states in that. We have a lot of revenue debt, so like we have a housing development authority. It borrows billions. It lends them to housing developers in exchange for low-income housing. We've got a decent amount of that kind of debt. We've never defaulted on that. It's never been paid by taxpayers. If the housing market really gets screwed up, it might be an obligation, but it so far hasn't been a big factor. Where the debts really are high are in pension systems. So, We've accidentally made school employees the state's largest creditors. We've got less than $2 billion of official pension debt. We have over $30 billion in debt in this one system alone. When you compare Michigan to other states, there are some places that have huge problems with this. We're not the worst. We're not the best. We're a little more than average. But even then, there's complications because these states use different funding assumptions. They use different which can inflate or mitigate debt. So that's kind of been a complicated question, but we're not the best, we're not the worst.
Have you mapped quality of life index to the state tax rate top and bottom 10 rankings?
So a lot of the quality of life indices that you see out there, like, it's a really important question, because that is a really important question. A lot of the indexes tell you more about the worldview of the people that create the index than it does about how happy people are in those states. So I would expect that you, if you showed me a quality measure of quality of life, I would be happy to see it. I suspect that you'd find a lot of things that you don't expect. For instance, I fundamentally believe that high societal trust influences your quality of life, and that's probably got little to do with your tax policy.
I would just make the observation that I was looking at the top 10 business tax climate states, and two factors that seem to influence a lot of that are energy and no income tax.
Yeah, that's another thing. And Michigan has energy allotments. We're actually we collect money from the royalties that people pay the state based on, drilling for oil and natural gas in state lands. It's a constitutional question that we're going to be dealing with in November. I'm looking forward to writing an assessment of that. It's just not as big as it is in North Dakota and in Texas.
Next question. What's your opinion about raising the gasoline tax by 13 cents a gallon to raise the needed extra $3 billion that both the Snyder and Whitmer administration agrees we need for good roads and infrastructure?
Okay. We don't need $3 billion a year for roads and infrastructure. I mean, this has been, people have mentioned this a lot, but when you look at whether we're putting roads together faster than they're falling apart, according to the Transportation Asset Management Council, we're at replacement levels already. We can accomplish this by making roads a priority for growing revenues. I think that should be the goal, is to put roads together faster than they fall apart. I think we're really close to that goal right now. It's just a matter of prioritization. We are fans of user fee financing for roads. There's some reasons why gas taxes are kind of imprecise for that, especially considering that most local roads usage starts to get kind of weird with that. But and the fact that there's a lot of ways we diverge from user finance for that. But that's a conversation that we can have.
And that's a conversation we will have on June 23rd, Tuesday night, spoiler alert.
Yes.
30-minute version of why that is the case.
Yes, I hope you pay attention to that and practice.
Related question, can the governor issue bonds such as for roads without legislative approval? Where does the money come to pay the bond interest?
Okay, there's a question is like whether she can. Yes, she can, she has, it's been done in the past. There is this constitutional requirement that new state debts get approved of by voters. There's been some jurisprudence from the from the Supreme Court that has said, well, that really only applies to general obligation bonds. That is not anywhere in the state constitutional language. I think that that's a terrible decision. That's what we've had. It's been on our list of a question to raise. But right now, governors have been given the ability to unilaterally authorize a limited amount of debt that is dedicated to the roads. The governor has authorized some of that, but since the pandemic happened, she hasn't actually floated the bonds, at least as far as I can tell. So authorize the debt. We haven't actually issued it. I think that's a bad policy in general, because it doesn't get you any more road funding. It gets you the exact same amount of road funding plus interest payments, which is not the best way of paying or of getting more road funding.
Next question. Are we managing all the unfunded liabilities? Is there light at the end of the tunnel?
There is never a solid answer to this question until you pay it all off, because the future is always uncertain. But what we have done is really good, which is we've tried to not develop more new debts. As in, like, when employees are working now, they're operating in plans that can't be underfunded by using bad assumptions and deferring debt obligations. And on top of that, we're etching away at the debt that we have by paying it down. Now, it used to be that the state wasn't even paying the what is the equivalent of the interest payments on this debt. We're past that. We're paying it down. It's expensive. It's going to be a matter of how important is it for future legislators to keep paying this down. And that's an important issue for you guys to consider in the future.
How do we find out where Michigan has invested tax dollars and how much revenue Michigan makes on those investments?
Okay. So all of that is in the state's comprehensive annual financial reports, but really the best place to get that, Treasury Bureau has a Bureau of Investments, and it's mostly about the state's pension funds, which are most of its investments. Bureau of Investments, they have quarterly reports. I track that because it's important to know whether, you know, when the state says that it has $63 billion, is that the market value or is that just what they're saying the value is? One of the interesting things about the state's investments is that it used to be like, I went back, the pension system is 100 years old. I went back to when it first started and they were investing exclusively in high quality government bonds. So low interest, high certainty that governments are going to pay these things. And now it's not. They've even moved away from like standard domestic, you know, the standard domestic stock markets. They're in a lot of private equity deals. They're in a lot of real estate deals. They've really changed their investment portfolio in order to chase after market returns. And it hasn't allowed them to catch up.
And we have two more questions before we switch gears a little bit. First one is, are there restrictions on lawmakers from taxing stock trading and capital gains?
I don't think there are, because a lot of those questions are matters of state sovereignty, and the state is fundamentally in control of its tax policies. I think there have been some states that have done some special capital gains things. Michigan is not one of them. I mean, your investment returns are subject to personal income taxes. You know, if you're day trading, it counts as short-term income. You're paying 4.25% on them, like everyone else that has gains and investments. So, yes, we do tax them already. We don't have special taxes on them.
And last question for James, what are your thoughts on sales taxes for services?
So this is a long-term question. I will say that one of the things that I think is really important is to have popular control over fiscal policy. We've talked about sales taxes on services, and so far it's been a very heavy lift, even for states that have tried to say, look, we're just trying to broaden the base of this rate and lower the rate. That tends to be better policy than high taxes on a narrow selection of goods. But when you look at base broadening things, it tends to be on things that are unpopular. Like there are Democrats that don't think that a lot of medical goods should be subject to sales taxes. That's a base narrowing proposal. And so it's been very difficult for lawmakers to try and do base broadening. It's just been unpopular. There hasn't been a lot of effort made to convince people that it's a good idea. It's something that, you know, I'm a little skeptical of, because most of the time it's just, we're in a financial emergency. What taxes can we raise? That's what happened in 2007 with the sales tax on services. But, you know, it's not something that I think, as a person who supports broad bases and low rates, I can immediately take out of hand or immediately disregard.
Well, thanks, James. And at this point, I will load up the second part of our presentation tonight, which is related to the question of taxes and budget, and it's about the state appropriations process, which some of you, if you are elected in November, will have the opportunity or mispleasure to be a part of. So this, what I'm going to walk you through over the next 15 minutes or so, is actually a document that we produced about a year ago at this time, actually a little bit more than that, when committees came out and we saw that there were 14 first-time legislators who were members of the House Appropriations Committee, and four of them being subcommittee chairs. And it's like, we'll do a quick show of hands. How many of you feel like you could go into the legislature today and smartly analyze the budget and come up with responsible for the licensing and regulatory affairs department and all the programs in there? Okay, let me see some hands. Okay, that's what I thought. So the idea was not to come up with a single resource for the whole budget, but a methodology that allows people to be able to get the information they need in order to be able to make responsible decisions. So what happened here? It's just on my screen. So really a few key points that you need to think about as you're approaching the budget process. Legislators have to authorize the state budget every year. That means you need to reach consensus with your colleagues about what are the priorities and how do we spend taxpayer money most effectively. All policymakers have the responsibility to ensure that any program that gets taxpayer money produces maximum results for the resources received. The challenge is, how do you achieve that goal when limited knowledge of and interactions with the agencies you're funding, and at least initially, a limited experience with the appropriations process? Key point, and why I've got it in all caps, is no matter whether you're $3 billion in the green or $3 billion in the red, the sum of the budget requests you will get will always exceed the available revenues. So the responsibility that you have is not to allow government agencies and their programs budgets to operate on autopilot. Provide the responsible scrutiny to be able to understand what is important to do, what would we like to do if the money is there, and what can we reallocate toward other priorities, whether it's other functions of government such as roads or shoring up teacher pensions or returning money to the taxpayers who paid it in. So what we came up with were a list of questions which legislators can ask of agencies and in the appropriations process to be able to get the basic background on the programs that will inform the second layer level of questions that will help you determine policy priorities and spending priorities. So there are five buckets that the questions fall under. First one is dealing with the origins and the legal authority of the program. Legislators have a responsibility to understand where every program you fund came from, how it started, what were the dynamics that caused the program to come into existence. When you're funding programs, the way you ought to prioritize should be, first of all, if there are functions or programs that are specified in the Michigan Constitution, those should get first consideration. Then, after that, the programs that are authorized by statute. Now, if a program exists, and I don't imagine that you would find that happening here very often at all. You see this more as an issue in states with part-time legislators, where an agency may have gotten executive directive to create a program because of a federal funding opportunity. But if you find a program that doesn't have constitutional backing or a statute behind it, you have two options. Number one, you can create a statute to authorize the program with the conditions and the constraints that you authorize, or you should consider doing away with the program. Second area to look at are federal funds. Almost 40% of Michigan's federal budget in 2019 consisted of federal funds. That was not shown up in the table that James had earlier, I don't believe. But state government's acceptance of federal funds almost always comes with strings attached. In some cases, there is a matching fund requirement. case in point, Medicaid, where we have to, every dollar we pull up pulls down a percentage of federal funds from DC, or a maintenance of effort requirement that at the point that we agree to start a particular program, that we will not cut expenditures in that area below the level that it was when we initially started. And second of all, there are laws or rules that states must adopt to receive federal funds. You need to be careful, particularly with this, when it comes to the federal stimulus funds. I know that when I was in Texas and my previous employer, there were a number of strings related to federal funds that came down as part of the stimulus package. And in the case of the unemployment insurance program, would have required a permanent, hold on. Oh, my mic is going in and out. Okay, can you hear me better now? Put something in the chat window and let me know whether audio is working better. So, but so there are federal funds that, going back to the Texas example, you had the unemployment insurance program that the state was offered like $550 million to be able to cover a shortfall in its fund if the legislature adopted a permanent change to who is eligible for benefits that would have permanently increased taxes on employers, and the legislature decided, you know what, we'll let that pass, we'll find another way to close the shortfall. There are things that the feds can require you to do, but the Supreme Court over the last few years, particularly the NFIB versus Sebelius decision, put limits on the federal government's ability to strip existing funding from states that refuse to comply with newly adopted conditions. So understand the extent to which your program decisions are constrained by federal law and rules. Also understand where there may be waiver opportunities and timelines for such. Particularly in the health and human services area, the federal government has created opportunities for state flexibility through waiver programs, and that those can be a way to come up with a customized package of benefits or delivery mechanism that better suits Michigan than the one size fits all that creates in the rules. So our encouragement to you would be to make sure that you are pressing state officials when they're coming before your committee to pursue every opportunity to obtain the maximum flexibility for the benefit of Michiganders. So let me, third area of questions deals with performance evaluation. One of the games that agencies may play from time to time is try to throw numbers at you and confuse inputs with outcomes. So the metrics you're looking at for a particular program should show progress toward discrete objectives as opposed to mere activity. So it is one thing to, you know, provide job training to 500 people. It is another thing to say that, okay, did we have 450 of them get the jobs that matched up with the training, or was it 100? So when you're looking at performance evaluation, take a step back as far as you can and think about what would ultimate success for a program look like. Overarching goals should be ambitious but realistic. Fighting hunger is not a goal but an activity. A goal such as reducing food insecurity to 10% by comparison is a realistic, achievable goal where you can measure the progress. When you understand what ultimate success looks like, then you can come up with the metrics that point you to how you're doing. See what other states are reporting, but don't limit yourselves to their metrics. There are other states that are doing similar things to what Michigan does. Take a look at their websites. Take a look at their appropriations boilerplate. See what their data systems are tracking and reporting so that you can know how those programs are doing relative to us and how they're tracking and staying on top of performance. As a legislator, you have the ability to require reports, or you can alter existing reports that the agencies produce as a part of the appropriations process. Michigan's Open Government Initiative includes information on the strategic direction and current performance levels of each of the executive branch agencies. You should make sure that the agency scorecards related to that are kept current. And lastly, when performance analysis by an agency is outsourced to a consultant to tell you how they're doing, make sure that you understand the selection process and the methodology of the consultant. A lot of these reports have a tendency, unfortunately, to be rather self-congratulatory. Make sure that the analysis is independent, rigorous, and not compromised by ethical conflicts. Fourth area that we are looking at is funding levels. You need to look beyond what was done last year to understand the funding trends for a particular program function. When we have a downturn such as this, it's going to be very important for you to know which are the programs that have benefited during the last growth cycle versus ones which have already taken their haircut. So when you're looking at a long-term pattern, whether it's 5 years or 10 years, the trend, make sure that the adjustments include CPI inflation. That is the inflation that's the best metric for what your constituents are paying as far as their income and prices for goods. A lot of government agencies will try to sell you on other metrics that the primary purpose of it is to give you 2, 3, 4x what the consumer price inflation bump would be. So when there have been fluctuations in long-term funding trends, try to understand the backstory behind them. Maybe there was a federal funding opportunity that came in. Maybe there was a growth in funding because of a new tax that came into effect. Whether there was a change in federal funding streams, state tax revenues, legislature setting different priorities. Understand what caused things to go up or down. Other factors to take a look at, what are the client caseloads? What are the cost drivers in a particular program? How many full-time employees have has a program had over the course of time? And lastly, in this area, there was a big push toward financial transparency among state and local governments about a decade ago. You should make sure that a check register of agency expenditures is readily available on the website. Having financial transactions posted publicly allows more watchful eyes to evaluate the propriety of agency spending. It also creates a disincentive for agency management and the rank and file workers to approve wasteful or inappropriate expenditures. And lastly, just a few final thoughts as things you ought to look at. What is the broader landscape for a particular product or service? If there are multiple entities that are providing it, do we really need to be involved in it? Would it make sense to partner with another entity or to step out of the space and reallocate resources toward other priorities? Also look for opportunities to engage the private or charitable sector as contractors or partners in program operations. These are ways that you can improve service delivery and allow taxpayer money to be reallocated toward other needs. And then lastly, be aware of state audits for a department or a particular program, especially any negative findings that have come up. The audits are meant to improve program performance, operations, cost, and public accountability. You need to be aware where there are negative findings and make sure that you are pressing the agencies as to the extent to which they have remedied those findings. So that is my presentation. So let me see if there were any questions that any of you had in the chat room other than the volume level. I'm sorry for that at the early part of the presentation. Hopefully it will come back on the audio, or the audio will come out better. In any event, my slides will be there, and then also the original resource booklet will be on the Candidate University website. So I'll wait a little bit longer to get another, see if anybody has any questions about the what percentage of state GDP is tax? Let me unmute James Homan.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just barely. Probably be better if you had your headset in.
Yeah, my headset died. But send me an email. We'll get that to you. I've got the numbers and the trends available. It's less than 10%.
All right. Can you give us an example of a successful private or charitable sector involvement? I will let James take a shot if there's one that comes right to his top of his mind.
Yeah, foster care services, there's a lot of involvement with religious and private organizations in helping the state find homes for foster children and then permanent homes at, outside of the fostering process. I think something, it's a large percentage in West Michigan that goes through these private agencies. The state does a lot of contracting and then it has a professional process for reviewing contracts. As you can tell from the news, sometimes they do get in the news for not being as professional as they should be, but the state has a ton of contracts that it works through, evaluates, and recontracts each year.
All right, I will keep track of the GDP percent is tax question, and we will get an answer to that to you via email. So, all right, well, there being no other questions in the chat room, appreciate you. Actually, hold on, one more. Do you have an infographic that maps constitutional and other required spending by requirement, its source, and general fund expenditures that are required to make up the difference?
Yes, so it's in that House Fiscal Agency three-column document that I sent, so that should be in there. I can send you a link to it as well. And then for further details about restrictions that are put on, there's a report that the HFA puts out, the House Fiscal Agency puts out, called the Revenue Source and Distribution. I think that that'll give you even more details on top of the one chart. And I'll make sure to send that to you guys as well.
All right. Well, thanks everyone for joining us again tonight. Have a great weekend on the campaign trail, and we'll look forward to seeing you back Tuesday, where you have James and Mike Lefebvre, everyone. They will be walking you through the pension issue and then also the state's economic development / corporate welfare policy. So thanks everyone. See you Tuesday.
Thank you.